So picture this. You're sitting at like a really polished, minimalist sushi counter.
Oh, I love those places.
I
Hunched atmosphere, right?
exactly. It's quiet. The chef is meticulously slicing fish right behind the glass, and you're just sitting there trying to decode the omakase menu.
Which is always a challenge.
It really is. So let's say a friend recently gifted you this elegant fish identification deck, like an omakase union, designed to demystify exactly what you're about to eat.
Right, so you're feeling prepared.
Yeah, you pull it out, ready to be this highly informed diner, only to discover a fatal flaw.
Let me guess. The translation matrix completely falls apart the second it hits the real world.
It completely falls apart. I mean, the English translations on these beautiful cards are entirely in Latin binomials.
Oh, wow. That's not helpful at all.
Right. The menu in front of you says something straightforward like, ah, hamachi. And you look down at your guide, and it is stubbornly telling you about the physical characteristics of Pseudocurrens dentex.
Which is technically accurate, but.
But completely useless. I mean, you can't exactly lean over the counter and ask the chef for a fresh slice of Thunus orientalis. It's a beautifully designed piece of media that is functionally useless in context.
Yeah, the gap between scientific taxonomy and the, colloquial language printed on a restaurant menu is massive.
Totally.
An encyclopedia might give you the biological truth, but you need the cultural truth to actually order dinner.
Exactly. So today's mission for this deep dive is to look at a builder log from a creator who ran into this exact friction, and they engineered it completely out of existence in a single afternoon.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. They acted as the editor-in-chief of a small team of AI agents, and the output was this free 92-page, 73-fish omakase field guide.
That's a massive deliverable for one afternoon.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this, because framing this as just a fun weekend project for sushi lovers, well, it completely misses the point.
Oh, absolutely.
This is really a masterclass in modern sheep coordination and how we can architect automated workflows to solve highly specific data-heavy problems.
Yeah, because the field guide itself is just like the exhaust from the actual engine they built.
Right.
The fascinating part is the architecture of that engine.
Right. Where do you even start with something like that?
Well, if you want to build a comprehensive reference school covering 73 different fish, your baseline requirement is data.
Lots of it.
Exactly.
All right.
And gathering nuanced cross-reference data historically meant days of manual Wikipedia scraping and, cross-referencing glossaries.
Yeah, you really have to outsource that heavy lifting now. But the approach here wasn't just throwing one massive prompt at a language model and asking for a spreadsheet.
No, that would lead to massive hallucinations and drop data. Instead, the builder initiated a multi-agent workflow for the research fan-out stage.
Okay, so breaking it up.
Right, they spun up nine separate AI agents running in parallel. And the crucial architectural decision here was assigning one specific fish category to each agent.
Like partitioning the workload.
Exactly. One agent is exclusively locked into researching akami, the red meat fish. Another is restricted entirely to shiromi, the white fish.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, and a third handles hikaramono, the silver-skinned varieties, and so on through the shellfish, shrimp, and crab.
Wait, I have to ask though, why partition the work that rigidly? Like, if you have an LLM with a massive context window, couldn't you just feed it a list of 73 fish and tell it to output the data in one go?
The fair question.
I mean, it feels like building nine separate agents is overcomplicating the fan out, no?
It seems that way until you really look at how attention mechanisms work in language models. If you give a model 73 distinct entities to research simultaneously, its attention just dilutes.
It gets confused.
Right? It starts blending characteristics. It might accidentally assign, like, the seasonality of a winter whitefish to a summer shellfish.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So by compartmentalizing the agents, you restrict their operational universe. The akami agent only has to focus on red meat fish, ensuring it drills really deep into the specific textures, prep methods, and Japanese kana for that specific category.
Without its context window getting polluted by unrelated data. So
Exactly.
you force focus to force accuracy. And they were structuring this data strictly, right? They weren't just asking for paragraphs of text.
No, they needed specific fields populated. Chinese name, Japanese kana, romaji, seasonality, counter-spotting tips, and common confusion pairs.
Like what this fish looks identical to when it's sitting on a ball of rice.
Right, exactly. But this actually brings up the most dangerous part of automated research, which brings us right back to your menu problem at the sushi counter.
The English translation. Yeah, I read this part of the builder log, and I genuinely questioned the methodology for a second.
Yeah.
The builder used a complex web search agent specifically to find out what a fish is called in English. And I'm thinking, wait, why deploy web searches? If the agent already has the Japanese name, why not just run a standard translation command?
Well, because language models are trained to optimize for the statistically likely literal translation.
Right.
They are optimized for accuracy in a vacuum, not accuracy in a specific cultural environment.
Ah, so the model gives you the textbook answer, not the street answer.
Exactly. Let's look at the Japanese fish, tai.
Okay.
If you pass that to a standard translation prompt, the model looks at its training weights and confidently states that tai translates to sea bream.
Which is technically true. Right?
It is technically correct. But if you walk into the majority of sushi restaurants in America, sea bream is nowhere on the menu.
They call it red snapper. I see it all the time.
Right. So if your automated guide translates it to sea bream, but the menu in front of the user says red snapper, your tool has failed its primary use case.
Wow. Yeah. It's functionally useless again.
So the builder anticipated this blind spot. For that critical field, the U.S. menu English name, they barred the agents from relying on internal memory.
They forced a reality check.
They forced the agents to initiate a web search, parse live U.S. restaurant menus, and tally the actual terminology being used in the real world.
That is so smart. They built an automated reality check. The overarching lesson there is really verify, don't trust.
Absolutely. The model's internal weights are not a substitute for live data.
Okay, so the fan-out stage successfully generates this highly structured, culturally accurate text database. But, I mean, a field guide requires visual identification. You need photos.
You do.
And hiring a food photographer to source and shoot 73 specific species of fish is a logistical nightmare. So they utilize GP'd Image 2 to generate roughly 150 photorial images.
Yeah, two specific shots per fish. You need the whole fish for market level identification, and you need the plated nita, the actual slice resting on the rice, for counter level identification.
Right. But generating the images sounds straightforward until you realize how you have to prompt an AI to draw a biological organism accurately.
It's surprisingly difficult.
It's remarkably similar to directing a police sketch artist. If you sit down and just say, draw a skipjack, the model is going to default to a generic clip art silhouette of a fish.
Yeah, you have to actively describe the visual evidence.
Right. The fidelity of the image generation doesn't stem from the model's inherent understanding of marine biology. It stems entirely from the descriptive constraints placed upon it.
So the builder couldn't just pass the names of the fish to the image generator.
No, they had to instruct the research agents to first write highly specific visual descriptors.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, they had to tell the image prompt, make sure the skipjack has distinct dark longitudinal stripes on its silver belly.
Right.
Or for the ishidai, render prominent vertical black bars across the body.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a kinmadai, you have to force the prompt to emphasize the oversized eyes and the striking deep red skin. Yeah, when you force the model to render those specific traits, it suddenly produces an image you can actually use for identification.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this visual pipeline perfectly illustrates the builder's central thesis, which really serves as the philosophical backbone of this entire project.
Which is what?
Agents for the fan out, code for the spine.
Okay, I grasp agents for the fan out. That's dispatching the AI to do the messy, fuzzy work of scouring the internet, structuring text, and, you know, hallucinating images of fish.
Right.
But code for the spine implies a sudden shift away from all that flexibility. Are we saying the AI is totally barred from the actual assembly process?
Absolutely barred. The spine is the third stage of the build.
Yeah.
The assembly. And this stage was entirely deterministic.
No AI involved.
None. AI is inherently probabilistic, right?
Yeah.
It guesses the next best pixel or the next best word. You do not want a probabilistic system designing a 92 code layout.
Definitely not. It would be a mess.
So the builder wrote a deterministic code generator that took all the verified JSON data from the agents and emitted it as rigid print-styled HTML.
Oh, got it. So they just piped that HTML through headless Chrome to render the PDF.
Exactly.
The AI is treated purely as a subroutine. The code calls the AI for content, grabs the asset, and drops it into a locked template.
The AI is never the driver. As the builder noted, layout is a place for determinism, not vibes.
I love that. Layout is a place for determinism, not vibes.
Because if you let an AI manage your layout, it might creatively decide to alter the margins on page 40 just because the statistical weights favored a different formatting style for Shellfish.
Which would drive you crazy. But, you know, even with that strict division of labor, messy AI for content, rigid code for assembly things, still broke during production.
Of course they did.
The builder logged a few debugging war stories that reveal a lot about how these pipelines actually function under stress.
Yeah, the first major issue occurred during the image generation phase. The builder labeled it the tuna-shaped bug.
The tuna-shaped bug. I love the name.
Right. Generating 150 high-resolution images sequentially using a standard API key is a massive bottleneck. They were hitting rate limits of about 10 requests per minute.
That is painfully slow. So to circumvent that crawl, they swapped to a faster API endpoint that allowed for aggressive parallelism, meaning they could hit the image generator with dozens of requests simultaneously.
Which is great in theory.
Right. But the moment they instituted that parallel architecture, the pipeline fractured. Every single image of the plated Nita succeeded, but every single whole fish request hard failed.
Yeah, and when you encounter a failure state like that, you have to isolate the variables.
Exactly.
They're pushing through the exact same text prompts routed to the exact same foundational model running on the exact same parallel script. So why does one category execute flawlessly while the adjacent category fails 100% of the time?
It usually comes down to legacy artifacts, and in this case, it was the requested image dimensions.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, the whole fish prompts were hard-coded to request a resolution of 1792 by 1024. That's an older aspect ratio.
Right.
The slow sequential API endpoint was silently accepting that legacy size and likely handling the crop on the back end. But the new high-speed endpoint was strictly governed.
It just rejected it outright.
It rejected the legacy dimensions outright and required 1536 by 1024. A simple dimension update in the code resolved the entire blockage.
The underlying engineering truth there is just timeless, though. When a system failure splits perfectly along a single axis in this instance, plated versus whole, the bug resides exclusively on that axis.
You don't rewrite the prompt logic.
Exactly. You search for the single parameter separating those two states.
But the bugs weren't just in the AI calls. The deterministic assembly had its own localized failure.
Right, the appendix bug.
Yeah. At the end of this field guide, there is a comprehensive 82-row order cheat sheet. It's meant to be a quick scan table. But when they initially piped the HTML into the PDF render, the table just exploded. It sprouted half-blank pages, and it was slicing fish names horizontally across page breaks.
See, this is the danger of trusting default layout behaviors. If you dump a massive table into a standard DOM rendering engine, it prioritizes content flow over pagination logic.
Right.
It doesn't know it's building a book, you know, it thinks it's building a scrolling web page.
Yeah.
It will break a row wherever the pixel height limit dictates.
Now, I would assume the fix there is just writing some aggressive CSS to force page breaks before the table rows.
You'd think so, but CSS page break rules are notoriously finicky across different rendering engines. Relying on them is kind of hoping the browser interprets your suggestion correctly.
Well, what did they do?
The builder didn't rely on CSS suggestions. They forced programmatic chunking. They wrote logic into the code generator to count the rows, calculate the vertical height, and explicitly bound the pages.
Wow.
Yeah, they injected a hard rule. Never allow a page to terminate on a section header.
Tell the system exactly where the page ends rather than asking it nicely.
Exactly.
It's taking control away from the automated renderer precisely where precision is non-negotiable. So they squash the bugs, the pipeline is flowing, the layout is locked. At this point, the project is essentially ready to ship.
And this is where a traditional software project would enter feature freeze.
Right.
But because of the architecture they built, they executed a mid-project pivot that would normally require days of tedious manual data entry to pull off.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Right near the finish line, one of the research agents surfaces a completely separate data set.
Completely out of left field.
Right. It's a list of 71 sushi fish, but instead of taxonomy and seasons, this data contains numeric taste profiles. It scores the fat content, the firmness, and the aroma of each fish on a rigid 1-to-5 scale.
Which is such valuable data.
Even better, it includes a specific hex color code for the flesh of each piece of fish, giving a precise digital value for the UI to render the exact shade of red or pink.
So now the builder possesses a 73-fish foundational guide and a newly discovered 71-item dataset containing specialized taste metrics. Merging those manually is a logistical headache. You have overlapping names to reconcile, formatting to standardize, and crucially, two missing fish that exist in the main guide but aren't present in the new taste dataset.
Right. How do you align a 71-item list with a 73-item list without human intervention? I mean, you can't just tell an LLM to merge these or it will hallucinate the missing numbers randomly.
No. You deploy a new agent and utilize the discovered dataset not as raw text but as a rating rubric.
A rubric.
Yeah. The builder instructed the AI to ingest the 71-item list to establish a baseline understanding of how fat, firmness, and aroma correlate to specific biological families of fish.
So it's essentially few-shot prompting on a massive scale.
Exactly.
The AI looks at the fat content of the known tunas and mackerels, maps the biological proximity of the missing fish, and calibrates a highly educated estimate for the missing variables based on that rubric.
Precisely. By establishing that baseline, the 1-to-5 scale remains mathematically and logically consistent across the fish, explicitly detailed in the original dataset, and the edge cases the AI had to evaluate dynamically.
That's brilliant.
It's synthesizing and extrapolating data, not just copying it.
The manifestation of that pivot is incredible. Now, on every single card in this 92-page PDF, alongside the research and the photos, you have a discrete visual bar chart charting the fat, firmness, and aroma.
It looks so professional.
Plus, a UI element perfectly color-matched to the hex code of the fish's flesh. It's a massive injection of value that required almost zero manual labor to implement.
Which brings us to the final deliverable. We've locked down the cultural terminology, stabilized the layout, and calibrated the taste profiles.
Right.
How do these technical victories translate into a practical tool for the user?
Well, the end result is a polished, highly functional 92-page guide. It covers the 73 netta segmented across 9 biological categories. But the data fan out also surfaced necessary context that elevates this beyond a simple visual dictionary.
The supplementary tools are arguably as important as the species identification.
Absolutely. The research agents pulled a comprehensive prep technique glossary. And the reason this matters is that knowing how a chef alters the protein is often more indicative of the final taste than the fish itself.
Oh, for sure.
The guide breaks down techniques like zouk, which is soy marinating, kobujime, curing between kelp to transfer umami, aburi, lightly searing the top, and nigiri, the specific soy glaze brushed on right before serving.
And perhaps most critically, the web verification agents that were scanning those U.S. menus surfaced distinct safety and authenticity warnings that actually made it into the final document.
Yes, the menu warning page is vital. Because the agents were scraping live culinary data, they kept hitting alerts regarding white tuna.
Ah, yes. The infamous white tuna.
The guide explicitly warns the user that the white tuna on many American menus is actually a snake mackerel called escaller, which contains a wax ester that the human body cannot digest.
A polite way of saying it acts as a very aggressive, very sudden laxative.
Exactly. It also trains the user to interrogate the menu. Are you eating bluefin, big eye, or yellowfin?
Huge difference in price and taste.
Right. It highlights that salmon, despite dominating modern menus, has zero roots in traditional Edome sushi. And it flags the legal reality that fugu, or pufferfish, requires a federally licensed chef due to its lethal tetrodotoxin.
Yeah, you don't want to order fugu at a discount strip mall sushi joint.
Definitely not.
All of this contextual intelligence is capped off by that flawlessly paginated 5-page order cheat sheet for rapid counter-reference.
It's just so complete.
But zooming out from the sushi itself, this raises an important question about the modern state of creation. When you analyze this builder log, what is the actual competency on display here? It certainly isn't just prompt engineering.
No, prompt engineering is a localized tactic. The real paradigm shift here is that complex coordination has become practically free.
Free and fast.
Right. Running 9 specialized parallel researchers, executing a web verification script to ground translations in reality, managing API failovers for hundreds of image generations, calibrating missing data against a 71-point rubric, and orchestrating a deterministic HTML to PDF assembly line.
It's a lot.
That is a robust enterprise-grade production workflow.
And the builder deployed and managed that entire infrastructure from a laptop in a single afternoon.
In one afternoon.
The manual labor of data entry and formatting was just engineered out of the equation. The human's role shifted entirely to architectural review.
So what does this all mean for the people listening right now? The compounding skill in the current technological landscape is architectural.
Yes, absolutely.
It is possessing the judgment to know exactly where to enforce rigid determinism, like locking down your data schema, forcing programmatic pagination, and relying on HTML, and knowing where it is highly advantageous to let the multi-agent fan out run while to gather, synthesize, and evaluate data.
Because if you can master that specific division of labor, the speed at which you can manifest complex finished products is staggering compared to even 24 months ago.
It's about stepping out of the role of the assembly line worker and into the role of the factory architect.
That's a great way to put it.
So to bring this full circle back to that minimalist sushi counter, the next time you sit down, the chef offers a slight bow and the menu proudly lists hamachi, you won't be referencing Latin binomials or generic biological traits.
No pseudocorax dentex for you.
Nope. Because of this afternoon of cheap coordination, your automated guide will tell you exactly what you need to know. It's young yellowtail, its fat content peaks in the winter, the flesh is firm and clean, and you need to watch out because it is visually identical to kampachi. You are fully informed. All that's left to say is, itadakimasu.
It completely shifts the dynamic of how we can build tools to interact with the physical world. And it leaves us with a highly provocative thought to consider.
What's that?
The barrier to architecting highly specialized, deeply personalized software utilities has essentially fallen to zero. This wasn't commissioned by a publishing house. It was willed into existence by one person acting as an orchestrator.
Right.
If you had an intelligent, multi-agent production line waiting idly for your architectural instructions this afternoon, what mundane, everyday friction in your own life would you engineer completely out of existence by dinner time?